Raptors are the predators of the sky, hawks, owls, falcons, and eagles. Like all the predators in Iowa, they were looked on with suspicion by early settlers and nearly disappeared. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk about Iowa's birds of prey with John Stravers and Dean Rosa. They're both contributors to the new book, The Raptors of Iowa. We'll also talk about the remarkable paintings of the late James F. Landenberger that illustrate the book. Later in the hour, most Iowans are familiar with the work of nationally syndicated cartoonist Brian Duffy, who spent 25 years at the Des Moines Register. He's still drawing, but today we're going to talk about his paintings of rural Iowa. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with cartoonist, artist, and avid cyclist Brian Duffy. But first, we're going to talk about Iowa's birds of prey. A new book, The Raptors of Iowa, has just been published by University of Iowa Press. The book features the artwork of the late James Landenberger, a wildlife artist who passed away in 2003. The book also features the essays of four men who've studied these birds in Iowa, and with me this hour are two of those men. Dean Rosa is here. He was Iowa State ecologist from 1975 to 1992. Hello, Dean.
Hi, Charity. Hi, John.
Thank you so much for being here today, John Stravers. Dean, you're introducing him for me. John Stravers is also here. He is the Driftless Area Coordinator for the National Audubon Society's Mississippi River Initiative and founder of the Big Blue Sky Music Project. Hello, John.
Morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And I want to start by talking about the work of James Landenberger, because that is at the core of this book. And he set out to actually paint pictures of all of the raptors that live in Iowa, John? That was his goal?
Yeah, he painted a lot, but he had that as a dream. I think Dean can speak to this, but he was a remarkable artist. And I think of him as the John James Audubon of Iowa. And I'm sure Dean has some ideas about that, too, but remarkable artist. I'm sorry that he wasn't around to see this publication, but it's a great tribute to him.
Well, and Dean, do you know very much about his goal to make this complete catalog of all of these different raptors in Iowa?
Yeah, the comparison to Audubon is apt in this case, because Audubon was very careful about not only the pose of the bird, but also the background. And even though he didn't paint the backgrounds himself, he supervised it, and he was very particular about what background was used. And this is true of Landenberger's work. You can look at the background, and you can identify for sure what plant he was using. And so there is a very good comparison to Audubon and Landenberger's work.
Well, and this artwork is really incredible. I mean, the pictures are beautiful, but he also, you can see when you look through the pictures that it was intended to be a collection, because every picture is different. I mean, they're all different species, of course, but none of them are in similar poses. None of them are doing similar things.
Yes, now, you can tell from that he not only had the sense about the bird, but you can tell that he did a lot of observing in nature itself. So these are poses from nature. They're not just, you know, a studio. He was an artist who took pride in his observations. He was not simply a studio artist.
Well, and in the opening essay of the book, which is by Rich Patterson, he is the director of Indian Creek Nature Center in Cedar Rapids. He was also a good friend of Jim Landenberger's. But he writes that as Jim was growing up, he fell in love with biology. He wanted to become a biology teacher. When he got to the University of Iowa, he was discouraged because he had a stutter. And he ended up then becoming an artist. But clearly, he was a teacher as well. When you look at these paintings, you can't help but learn something about these animals.
That's for sure. He did his teaching not through personal appearances, because he was self-conscious about his stuttering, but he certainly does, excuse me, educate people through the paintings.
I want to talk about these birds now, because I think that in Iowa, a lot of us are familiar with the more visible birds of prey, with red-winged hawks, for example, that we see so often as we're driving along the roadways. But there are so many of these birds that you don't see on a regular basis, that you don't hear on a regular basis. And I want to talk a little bit about the history of these birds. And I know that both of you have studied this. But when the settlers came to Iowa, these birds were considered to be a threat, right, John?
Yeah, everybody had chickens out, so they were considered vermin, or in the Spanish language, harm doers. And so they were shot or just being, you know, despised.
And as of so many animals in Iowa, it seems like whenever we talk about animals on this show, we tell almost the same story, that they were hunted nearly to the point of disappearing. Many of them did disappear from the state of Iowa. And many of them have been slowly making a comeback over time. Dean, can you tell me when you first became interested in raptors?
Probably around age 10. My first experience with raptors, as I describe in the book, is my brother and I saw this hawk flitting about our farm, and we grabbed our rifle, and an unlucky shot brought this beautiful sparrowhawk tumbling to the earth. And I'll always remember standing there in a late spring day with this dying sparrowhawk in my hand, and it's one of our most beautiful. And I think probably that triggered something in me that I felt bad about it, and it's triggered something in me that in later years I did delve into the study of hawks pretty seriously.
Almost as if you were always making amends.
Yes, that's what my wife thinks, at least. I would like to say something about Jim's art. He was one of the most generous of artists. Some artists you see are very protective of their work. Jim was not. He would donate art for the cover of the Iowa Conservationist. He did that on several occasions. He would donate art for the Iowa Ornithologist Union for the fundraising drives and so on. So his influence through that, his donating of these works of art, it was very important in his life.
Well, and I know that he donated a work of art to Indian Creek Nature Center, and that was really the thing that got Indian Creek Nature Center off the ground, was selling limited edition copies of his artwork. In reading about him, though, I was also struck by the fact that he, of course, sold paintings to make a living, but the paintings that he could sell to make a living were primarily of game birds or game species, the kind of things that you know, you see often a pheasant coming up out of the long grasses. And so I'm struck by how much of a labor of love these images are. And it's hard to believe that they aren't images that somebody would have wanted on their walls. And I think a lot of people would. But this was not something that he considered to be a commercially viable project.
That's true. I think he has done for the raptors of Iowa what Maynard Reese has done for the waterfowl of Iowa. You know, this, I'm so glad this book is being printed, because it's the second book that deals with the work of an Iowa artist. Maynard Reese has this wonderful book out on the works of Maynard Reese. It's a hardcover, a beautiful book. And this is a nice tribute to Jim. And I think that wildlife artists, by and large, have not been given anywhere near the credit that they should. When I look at some wildlife art, I think, you know, how well they handle colors, how well they handle mood, how well they handle backgrounds, and they're generally not considered part of the art scene, and I think that's unfortunate.
I want to talk about your experiences, John. When did you first start noticing raptors, thinking about raptors?
Yeah, that goes way back to a child just appreciating the beauty in nature, probably. And then as a young man in the U.S. Navy in Southeast Asia, I was impressed by raptors that I was viewing along the ocean. But it, I don't know, it came about with just being out and seeing stuff that I didn't always understand. And so wanting to understand a better understanding of that. And so then I got acquainted with Gladys Black, who taught me for several years, and then my
Iowa's bird lady.
Right, right. She was a completely unique teacher and just a wonderful influence. In fact, she got me started in the raptor studies, and I'm still doing raptor studies the same way she taught me, more or less, following the work of the Craighead brothers. And then I met Dean, and then that's when all this got started. And then he and Jim Bednarz first brought me into a red-shouldered hawk nesting area along Yellow River in northeast Iowa, and then that somehow the hook got set. And so here I am some 34 years later still chasing that bird, still visiting these same nesting areas year after year. So,
do you remember when you first went to that nesting area? Do you remember what you saw?
Yeah, or absolutely.
What was it about that experience that has stayed with you?
Well, it's kind of a mystic thing. It's the forest. It's a deep forest. It's big. It's huge. It's had a cathedral effect. It's a wet, huge forest. And these birds would travel the forest, but flying through it underneath the canopy. And then there's their call. It's this two-syllable kia, but it's just this wild thing that echoes through the water and the canyon walls. And so I guess I got addicted to that bird, that call, that habitat, that chase. And so there isn't anything that can get me to not do that in the spring, is to go find those birds and go into those same habitats. And, you know, that was 77, I believe, when we first went into that one nesting site. And so I was there in the last few days, and indeed red shoulders are still nesting in the same areas. So here I am still slogging away through those same habitats.
Well, and you write in the essay that's in this book about your efforts to try to understand how they communicate with one another.
Absolutely. Still trying to figure it out. It took me 13 years to realize that I didn't know anything.
Okay.
And then I started taking these elaborate notes on every situation where the hawks made a communication. And I took these elaborate notes on the duration of the kia, the repeat, how the duration, the amount of space between the sets of kias, and how, you know, started to try to establish the difference between the male and the female, and realized that if I did more listening, I could really be more efficient on this, finding the nests.
I'm talking to two of the contributors to a new book called The Raptors of Iowa that features the beautiful paintings of James F. Landenberger. With me today, I have John Stravers and Dean Rosa. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in just a few minutes, I'll be talking with cartoonist, artist, and avid cyclist Brian Duffy. But right now we're talking about the raptors of Iowa, the birds of prey of this state of ours, and also about a book called The Raptors of Iowa that features the paintings of James F. Landenberger, and it also features four essays. I have two of the essayists who contributed to the book with me today. With me is John Stravers. He's the Driftless Area Coordinator for the National Audubon Society's Mississippi River Initiative and founder of the Big Blue Sky Music Project, and Dean Rosa, who was Iowa's state ecologist from 1975 to 1992. They've both been involved in a number of different books that have been published about Iowa over the years as well. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And John, just before the break, we were talking about the red-shouldered hawks that you have been studying for many decades now. And in the essay that you contributed to the book, you write about trying to decode their communications. And you also write about seeing a breast feather from one of these hawks in a nest and interpreting that as a sign. Tell me about that.
Well, it was the work I do largely to find their nest and to understand the birds. You do a lot of the work in March when they're in courtship. And I was in the Snyder-McGill area, which is down by as long the Mississippi. It's near the area of the ceremonial mounds, the ancient ceremonial mounds. And there's always a red shoulder down there. And I wanted to – it was the season for them, but it was a little snowy. It was still cold, and we had a layer of hard, crusty snow. So the going was really tough. But I knew the birds should be on territory, and I think probably about the 7th or 8th of March, and I just wanted to hear that call. And so I was down there trudging around for 3 hours just – and I knew the birds were there, but they weren't saying a word. And so I was just disappointed because I wanted that fix of hearing the bird. And so I worked my way over to the old nest from last year and still hadn't heard a thing, and I was getting ready to leave. But I went to that nest and to see if they'd done any touch-up of it. And lo and behold, on the snow, curled up just neatly, was the small breast feather of a red-shouldered hawk. And so I knew they had been there. I knew they were there. So that instinct that they were there was true, even though I hadn't seen or heard them. And so I felt like it was like, okay, one of the birds had gotten back to the nest and left a little note. Honey, I'm home. I'm out hunting. I'll be back later.
Do you really think that's what it was? Do you think it wasn't an accidental leaving behind? I mean, it's impossible to know, of course.
It's impossible to know, but I can speculate. I'm the hawk man. I can do that.
Right. Dean, you write in your essay quite a bit about the nests of great horned owls, and I found that fascinating. Can you tell us a little bit about the nests of these owls and what you find in them?
Well, to use the word nest is a little bit misleading because owls don't, they just use an old nest of a hawk and or a cavity of a tree. They don't bother to build a nest. But my admiration for the great horned owl is beyond description, because I think it is one of the most ferocious, one of the most effective predators that we have in the state. And gosh, I found almost an unbounded array of prey in their nest, to the point where at one point I found there were two baby owls and there were several waterfowl bodies laying around the edge of the nest, to the point where I had to push the bodies of the waterfowl away so I could get down and feel the baby owls, almost to the point where they were smothering the baby owls.
That seems a little excessive.
Yeah.
Why do you think they stockpile so much food?
Well, because it's available. they time their I mean, nature has timed their the hatching of the young just at the peak of the waterfowl migration. And quite often, years ago, I was up every morning looking for, just watching, listening, enjoying birds. And I thought I was keeping up with what birds were piling into the area. And yet I would visit an owl nest and I would find birds there that I had not seen. So they were scooping me. They were more effective at determining what was there than I was.
Well, and you write a great deal about the great horned owls. I suspect they're one of your favorite species. And one of the fascinating things, I mean, you talk about how they're incredibly effective hunters. And when people see them, they look so wicked because they have those amazing yellow eyes and the horns. But you write about not just about their ability to take care of their own young, but that you have actually helped young that have been orphaned or displaced from their parents be fostered by other wild great horned owls. Tell
yes,
me about that.
Yes, that was quite common. I always had my eye on several great horned owl nests. So if someone brought me a young owl that had been orphaned, I knew right where I could go to get it new parents. And it didn't seem to matter what the age difference was. The little owls in the and the nest might be 5 days old, and this other owl might be, you know, a week and a half old.
Which would be a big difference.
Yeah, and they would just accept it no matter, without any question.
They would just take it in and feed it, even though that means sharing resources from their own genetic offspring.
Yes, that's right.
That's fascinating. You also, I know a lot of people think that when we talk about songbirds, that if a songbird comes out of a nest and somebody messes with it, then the parents won't take it back. I think a lot of people probably believe that about owls, too. But you also write about building a makeshift nest to put the owls back into a place where their parents could take care of them.
That height and my already great esteem for the owl, George Kanafis, a friend at Iowa State University, knew I was interested in owls, so somebody brought him two downy great horned owls that had been that popped out of a tree that somebody had cut down over near the town of Nevada, and he didn't know what to do with them, but he brought them down to me. And I knew I had to get them back in some kind of a nest yet that day. Otherwise, the owls would probably not hang around. And so I took a peach crate and put it in a tree, oh, I suppose 50, 60 yards from the original tree, because the original tree had been cut down. And I put the owls in the peach crate, and I hung around a little bit just to see what would happen, and pretty soon one of the adults came and landed in the tree above me and took a glance down at the owls and flew away. So I knew that she knew that they were there. And then we had this awful snowstorm of April, I think, 7th and 8th of 1973, I believe it was, one of the worst storms in history. And I just crossed off these owls. I said, there's no way they could live through that. So about 2 weeks later, I visited the nest, and there they were, healthy and happy as any owls I've ever seen. So that did a lot to substantiate my respect for the great horned owl.
I'm talking with Dean Rosa and John Stravers. They are two of the essayists who've contributed to the new book, The Raptors of Iowa, which also features really the remarkable paintings of the late James F. Landenberger. And you're welcome to join our conversation as well at 866-780-9100 or Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. Pat is on the line from Nevada. Hi, Pat.
Yes, good morning.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I was initially curious on the special kinship for these gentlemen's interest in specific the red-shouldered hawks and sound like great horned owls. But if you could please maybe discuss what does the future hold for these raptors and how your book may contribute to that overreaching educational aspect.
Well, Pat, thank you so much for your call. And I think before we talk about the future, let's talk about the present, because the raptor populations in Iowa have been increasing significantly over the last four decades now. And John, you write about some significant legislative changes that have made that possible.
Yeah, there's been a lot of positive changes. There are some species that are still struggling and probably will continue to do so. But, you know, in 1974, we had a single active bald eagle nest on the upper Mississippi River. Now there's hundreds, almost thousands. They're everywhere. And red shoulders that we thought were on the brink of being extirpated from the state seem to have had somewhat of a recovery, and some of the species are doing well. But, you know, for species like the northern harrier that take the grasslands, they're in a little bit of trouble now because we're putting so much of Iowa in crop ground. So there's a lot of questions, but certainly the attitudes toward the raptors hasn't changed. And we see that the Clean Water Act, which was passed, I believe, in 1973, had a profound effect on cleaning up the water and had profound effect on negative effect on peregrines, and now they're back. So there's a lot of reason for hope, and people are paying more attention. That's certainly true.
Well, I think when you mentioned the bald eagles, and you know, when I was a kid growing up in Iowa, I remember distinctly the first time I ever saw a bald eagle, and I was in my teen years, and I was along the Mississippi River, which was the only place in Iowa you could ever see a bald eagle at that time. Mm-hmm. And now they seem to be all over the place, and I live in Iowa City where a lot of them come and gather in the winter along the Iowa River. And my kids actually asked me one day, "Mom, why do you get so excited every time you see a bald eagle?" And I told them because I thought that my children would never get to see a bald eagle. Dean, do you want to add anything to the really remarkable comeback of so many of these species in Iowa?
Well, yeah, I'm old enough to have lived through a sea change in the attitude of people. You know, Iowa did not protect the hawks and owls legislatively until 1970. And I think it's important to note that Iowa has the distinction or something of being the most modified state in the Union. 96% of our surface is highly modified by crops or by cities or roads or something. And still, we have this, in some ways, a very remarkable raptor population. Not only has the bald eagle spread throughout the state, but the DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, is doing wonderful work in releasing into the wild ospreys and barn owls and peregrine falcons. And so if Iowa, with its 96% modified surface, can be as important to the population of raptors, you know, that's a pretty important sign. That's a pretty encouraging sign. And you have to look at the caller asked what the present is. The great horned owl, the red-tailed hawk, you know, they're sort of designed to live in Iowa. They can live close to habitation. They don't mind having a lot of agricultural fields. But as John said, there's certain species that are in trouble. And that's because of the loss of habitat for them.
We had a caller on the line who had to leave, but he asked about red-tailed hawks and the fact that it seems like we see so many of them now when we drive across the state of Iowa. Has there been a big jump in red-tailed hawk population?
Well, they're one of the species that do well in this patchwork of habitat that we have. So I don't believe there's been a great increase. I think there's been a great increase in people's in the popularization of raptors and in the feeling that they need to be protected. So I think people are just more cognizant of them.
Might be too, Dean, that as you say, the state is so modified, but yet we have this strip of grass all along the interstates. Well, the red tails have got used to using that little bit that's left. So many of the raptors that are out there are using that strip of habitat, even though it's pretty small.
That's
well,
right.
And Dean, you were talking about great horned owls, which strike me as an extremely adaptable raptor. You mentioned peregrine falcons, which, of course, we have understood have adapted quite well to cityscapes and can nest on tall towers. So is it that we're seeing an increase in some of the species that do seem to be able to adapt well to how we have changed the landscape?
Yes, I think that's the key to the bald eagle success. We had these hundreds and perhaps thousands of bald eagles wintering along eastern Iowa, and slowly an ecotype was selected from that did not mind nesting close to habitation. So I think those species that exhibit that characteristic of being able to deal with human habitation close are the ones that are doing well.
We only have about a minute left, and I want to get to the other part of Pat's question, which is, what does the future look like? And I'll ask it this way. John, what do you think the greatest challenges to raptor populations in Iowa are today?
corn production.
All right, in a nutshell, and taking a lot of formerly conservation land out of the CRP program and putting it into corn production.
Absolutely.
How about you, Dean?
Well, I think that's true. This rush towards biofuels has been really startling, and how many acres of habitat we've lost just in the last 10 years. And I don't think people have thought through the true ecology biofuels thing, but it is having a remarkable effect on a lot of wildlife. Raptors are the top of the food chain, so we see them affected most, but it's affecting everything else below them.
Dean, thank you so much.
Yes, certainly. Nice, always nice to talk about raptors.
Dean Rosa was Iowa State ecologist from 1975 to 1992. John Stravers, thank you for being here today.
Thanks for your work, Charity.
John Stravers is the Driftless Area Coordinator for the National Audubon Society's Mississippi River Initiative. He also regularly conducts backwater birding tours on the Mississippi River out of McGregor, Iowa. And also, I want to mention that Indian Creek Nature Center in Cedar Rapids is hosting a walk on Saturday morning at 8 o'clock this Saturday morning in honor of James F. Landenberger, the man who painted the amazing pictures that are in this book, because he was very instrumental in founding Indian Creek Nature Center in Cedar Rapids. The book is The Raptors of Iowa. Again, the paintings are by James F. Landenberger, and it is well worth a look. It's new from the University of Iowa Press. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk to cartoonist and artist Brian Duffy. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. James Landenberger painted some unforgettable images of Iowa wildlife, but now I'm going to talk to someone else who makes his living with unforgettable images. Nationally syndicated cartoonist Brian Duffy spent 25 years at the Des Moines Register. His editorial cartoons appear in over 400 newspapers, and he also draws for the Des Moines weekly paper City View and does animated cartoons for KCCI Television in Central Iowa. But I have asked him here today to talk about his paintings of rural Iowa. Hello, Brian.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, and since we get to see your work still, I think a lot of people maybe haven't realized that there has been a change. You were the last front page cartoonist for a newspaper in the entire nation, and then you joined your brethren as a freelancer, right?
Yes, I joined most of my brethren as a freelancer, and by the time I probably finish up my career, I'll be probably the last generation of American editorial cartoonists. We've been disappearing faster than the pheasants in Iowa, shall we say. It's just journalism right now, and especially newspapers, well, media in general, doesn't know the direction that they're going. So to save money, they're jettisoning the things that that really capture the reader's eyes.
Well, I think many of us are still very grateful that we get to see your work. But as I said, I want to talk not about your cartoons today, but about your paintings. And you are a bicycle enthusiast. I think that's important for people to know. So you log a lot of hours, don't you?
Not lately.
Well, with the snow and all.
Well, no. The snow has never had anything to do with it. It's workload. I first started out, to give a little bit of history on it, when I moved here and I'd heard about RAGBRAI, I thought, yeah, that's fine. That's great. You can ride your bike across the state of Iowa. I came from the Milwaukee area. Actually, I came from Wauwatosa, which is the hometown of Harley Davidson. And I always used to joke with John Karras, who was the co-host of and the co-founder of RAGBRAI, that the only way I'd do it is if I could do it on a Harley lowrider. But as a few years went by, and the fact that I'd lost a lot of connective tissue playing basketball, football, and soccer, I found that my sports limitations were narrowing down to a few things that really weren't beating my legs up that much. And cycling, all of a sudden, I just started riding it, and I went on RAGBRAI, I think, for 2 days back, I don't know how many years ago, and I just fell in love with it. And so since then, I've been doing just about every form of cycling that there possibly is.
What led you to start cycling on Iowa's back roads? A lot of cyclists try to stay off the very bumpy back roads of Iowa, but you've been out there seeing a lot of Iowa that a lot of people don't see.
Safety. That was the biggest thing. One of my best friends was Dr. Bob Breedlove. He had ridden on Paris-Brest-Paris, which was a 1,200-kilometer race across Paris. It's, in fact, older than the Tour de France, and it's a straight race. It goes from Paris to the West Coast and back again, and the first one makes it there is the winner. So you're talking about 40-some hours, 30-some hours worth, or about 40 hours in the saddle the entire time. And he had done the Race Across America, known as RAM, about four or five times, and in fact still holds the record for double transcontinental racing. He started in St. Louis, went out to the start of RAM, which was out in, I believe it was Long Beach, California, raced RAM with everybody else, and while everybody else was collapsing off of their bike, he turned around and came back to St. Louis in 21 days, and that record still holds. He was killed about 6 years ago while riding on RAM in Colorado, and I'd had quite a few close calls before then, but even since then, and I thought, I've had enough of the road. I want some place that's quieter. I don't care if it's rougher, if it's a rougher ride. It doesn't make any difference to me. And so I started riding gravel roads. There's a lot less traffic out there. And for some odd reason, I think it's a sound. The thing that caught me the first was the sound of the tires on the gravel that I really liked. And there were a group of us that started riding gravel riding it about the same way that we did on the road, which was at a fast pace, a race pace. But then I started going out on my own once in a while, and I'd slowed my pace down and just really looked around to see what was around me. And that was really the stimulus for a lot of these paintings.
You are famous as a cartoonist. Have you always done painting? Is that something that has been part of your life?
No, it's not. First of all, I'm colorblind, so it's kind of tough to paint that way when you have a deficiency like that. I've always said that God had a sense of humor. He gives me the talent to draw, but the color is just not there.
So when you say you're colorblind, are you literally colorblind, or are you saying that you don't have the appreciation for the colors?
Oh no, I am colorblind. Okay. In fact, when
so
I go
reds
in,
and greens or
reds and greens and yellows and you name the color, because there's a chart that you go an optometrist will give you, and they'll make a color check on it, and they have these circles on it, and there's numbers in the circles, and they're different colors, and everybody can pick out the number 32s and the 12s and whatever. I can't see anything. So it's kind of a game every time I go in there, because they bring everybody in the staff in to say, hey, look at this guy. He can't see anything but black and white. I can see shades of color, but it's really difficult to describe it. The only thing is that I had a friend who had discovered that if you wear one ruby contact in your eye, that in some cases it'll trick the mind to actually seeing cool colors and warm colors. First time I put it in my eye, I was just stunned. All of a sudden, there was a 3D world that I'd never seen before. And so I use that when I go out on rides, and I use that when I'm doing any kind of painting work, so that I can see, a warm blue versus a cool blue, greens and reds the same way. So it kind of opened my eyes that way, and that's when I started to use color and started to do watercolors.
Wow. So as you started to do watercolors, and there's a link on our Facebook page if you'd like to see some of these really beautiful watercolor images that Brian Duffy has painted of Iowa's rural landscape. When you started to do watercolors, did you have to study technique?
Yeah, I did. You have to study. Watercolors are probably one of the toughest mediums to really control, because once you put the color down, it's down. I mean, there's ways of scrubbing off color, but it takes quite a while. Some colors you can scrub off, other ones you can't. So it's not like oil painting or acrylics where you can just, you know, paint white right over it and then start again. It's something that you really have to lay out and get correct first, and I'll do rough sketches and maybe a couple of different watercolor washes, and then I'll do the final version of it.
Looking at the landscape that you were riding your bike through, knowing that you're colorblind and that you were not a watercolor painter, what made you pick up the brushes and start painting these pictures?
It was just the images. It was just when somebody's colorblind, what they miss in color, they pick up in tones and in contrasts. And what strikes me the most is the contrasts that I see. I like to do a lot of snowscapes because there's a bright contrast between areas of snow and the ground itself, the trees, whatever. And so I started in that direction, and I love the way that it breaks things up. It's a patchwork, almost a puzzle situation. And a lot of times when I'm riding by myself, what I'll do is it's not just what I see. It's something that will all of a sudden click in my mind. It might be the rustling of corn stalks caught on a fence row that just the sound of it will cause me to stop. Even the feeling of a cool breeze. There was one painting that I had done where I was riding along the gravel road, and this was in late winter, early spring, and all of a sudden you could feel this kind of warm outriders of spring in the winds coming along. It just it caught my eye, caught my senses, and then caught my eye. And I stopped, and there was just this great image there of a little bit of snow on the one side, and where the sun had hit the land, there were small puddles, but grass coming up. So I captured that in a watercolor. What I'll usually do, though, is that I'll photograph things that I see out there, then come back and use those photographs as the template for a lot of the paintings.
Do you try to stay true to the photograph, or do you alter it to meet what you want it to look like?
I take the electric lines out.
I was actually just going to ask that because I don't see any electric lines in your paintings.
Yeah, I take a lot of those types of things out, and I'll change a few things, but not a lot. I like to keep it as I've seen it. There'll be some things that change, but not a lot. It's the modern things that are gone. The one thing that you'll also notice is no people in my paintings. I do enough drawings of people in the caricatures, so I prefer to leave them out of it, and just the hints that people have lived there or existed there at one time or are kind of the ghost images of what I put down.
And you seem to have a fondness for abandoned buildings.
It riding as long as I have, and I started riding probably back in the mid 80s, and even back then, once in a while, I would go out with a few friends on gravel roads. And it's the change over the last 20 to 30 years has really been surprising, because there were places that I would go along where there were thriving farmsteads, and now the buildings are falling down. Sometimes the houses are completely gone. The barns are in very rough shape. So it's kind of a disappearance of a lifestyle that had existed, say, a century ago, that no longer exists out there. There's fields full of corn and soybeans, but the people don't live in the houses anymore, and there's very few houses out there.
Do you ever feel a contradiction? Because your images are, at least to my eye, they're really beautiful, but you're documenting the loss of something that a lot of us held very dear, and that is the family farm. Do you feel a contradiction between the sadness and the beauty?
Well, everything is bittersweet. And so in the painting, if you look carefully at it and you look at some of the barns that are in there, you can see the shape that they're in. and it gives that haunting look. Even if the scenery around it is gorgeous, there's that undercurrent of loss, and that's the thing that I try to bring out in a lot of the paintings. And what I really like are textures too. And I'll do a lot of those types of things in a painting. And the texture alone shows the rot, if you would say, of what is out there.
Do you see more of these images when you ride by yourself?
Oh, definitely, definitely. Because if I'm attempting to do that with a group of riders, I'm going to hit somebody, they're going to hit me, and we'll all go down, and it hurts because we usually ride at a pretty good pace. So I'll go out by myself and just go at whatever pace I want to and pick up whatever images that I see. It doesn't have to be any kind of grand vista. You know, that's the thing about Iowa is that, you know, we're not talking about Colorado or we're not talking about the Grand Canyon. We're talking about beauty in small increments, and that's the way you have to find them. And the best way of doing it is on a bicycle.
You're not a native Iowan, but it certainly sounds like in the decades you've spent here that Iowa has captured your heart.
Oh, gosh, no. I'm not a native Iowan. In fact, I was born in Chicago, Illinois, in Chicago itself, and I lived in New York. My father worked in Manhattan. I lived in Stamford, Connecticut, and also in Milwaukee. And I still remember the first time that I came to Iowa. I had an uncle that has passed away about 4 months ago. And the first time I went from Chicago to Iowa, I still remember sitting in the back of their car, driving along, and all of a sudden the big buildings are gone. And then there's some subdivisions there. And then there's nothing but green for miles and miles and miles and miles. And that was my first taste of Iowa is a completely different landscape than what I was used to.
The work that you do, you could do anywhere. But so much of your work is reflective of Iowa. I mean, in your cartoon work, you are the cartoonist of record, really, for the caucuses in Iowa, and now painting images of the Iowa landscape. It strikes me that this place really influences a lot of what you do.
It does. It really does, because you're right. It's crossed over to different art forms. So I still do the cartoons on the caucuses, because in addition to all of my other work, I started my own Iowa syndication. I wanted to prove that there can be media that can cover river to river like the Des Moines Register used to. So my cartoons that are strictly Iowa based start over in Dubuque, and I've got cartoons or newspapers that pick up my cartoons all the way over to the Sioux City Journal. So I go river to river on those, and they're throughout the state. So it keeps me grounded in what's going on in Iowa, because the cartoons mainly are based on what's going on in the legislature, what's going on in the weather. A lot of the things that I had done prior to leaving the Register, and I missed, so I figured out a way in which to do that. But, yeah, it's what I'm doing now as much as I can is to kind of cross-pollinate, if you will, using different forms of media to get my cartoons and my watercolors, images of Iowa across.
Brian, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Brian Duffy is most well known for being a nationally syndicated cartoonist. He spent 25 years at the Des Moines Register, and his editorial cartoons appear in over 400 newspapers. He also draws for the Des Moines weekly paper City View and does animated cartoons for KCCI Television in Central Iowa. You can see some of his watercolors on our Facebook page. Go to Iowa Public Radio and you can follow a link. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. This is Talk of Iowa.